Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Your Transformation Journey podcast. And today is our guest, Daniel Goss-Podark, and he is a mental health therapist. He is experienced in, good Lord, I am losing it today, y'all. And I'm going to leave this in because I think everybody needs to understand how we can flub up sometimes in podcasting.
Yeah.
His part of his professional career has centered around locked settings in jails and inpatient psychiatric hospitals. And he has also worked with survivors of traumatic experiences such as rape, domestic violence, warfare, neglect, child abuse, and institutionalization. He also has experienced traumatic brain injury, which both defined and challenged his identity and resolve. This experience instilled a deep level of empathy and authenticity to connect with and support the people that he works with to foster healing and growth. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Dawn. So excited to be here.
You are welcome. So I always ask our guests this one question. What got you started in doing what you're doing?
It's a big answer to a short question. So I would definitely say that July 2009, when I was in a severe auto accident, that's how I sustained my TBI, traumatic brain injury. That was kind of the precipice, right? That really started this journey. I didn't know where I would land in terms of a helping profession, but just from the support I received, I mean, I needed, you know, we can go into the details of the brain injury, but I essentially needed brain surgery, did, you know, 10 days ICU, 7 days inpatient rehab, and then 3 months of physical therapy and 17 months of speech therapy. So from that experience, I knew I was going to be somewhere in there. I didn't know where. Nurse, PT, OT, speech therapist. And then a little while after I was released from the hospital, I had a conversation with my sister, who's also a social worker. And she was like, hey, check out this profession. I did. I was pretty astonished at the latitude that social workers can work in many different roles in society, not just, you know, sometimes we think of social work as being CPS, right? And coming in and taking kids. And that's not always the case, right? And even CPS workers work to try to keep the family together as much as they can. That's healthy for the child. So I need to put that plug in there. And signed up for school, got into social work as an undergrad student, loved it, worked for a year and a half or so. And I couldn't really do what I wanted to do, like the one-on-one work that I really experienced in the hospital. It's really difficult to work in hospital settings if you only have your bachelor's in social work as well. So decided to get my master's, and, you know, here I am 14 years later. So it's been a wild ride.
It sounds like a wild ride. I have a sister that has a TBI. So I've had some experiences with a family member when you're going through that and the challenges with that and overcoming it. Mm-hmm. Is I don't think it's talked about enough because I don't think people really understand it. And the brain is amazing at rerouting, reorganizing, rewiring, however you want to frame it. It's really awesome at doing that. Back when I was growing up, you know, it wasn't realized that your brain could actually do that. Mm-hmm. At that time, when you sustained a TBI, they didn't think anything could change, but right. It does.
Yeah, the plasticity of the brain and just the brain in general is an area we know so much about, but we still have yet so much to learn.
Yeah.
I mean, just the beauty of being able to sustain an injury and then also rewire neural networks. Not even when you're young, but also when you're old, right? It's even when you're 70s or 80s, you can still have neurogenesis and establish new neural connections. And I think that also, speaks to, you know, people who have been through strokes, right?
Yeah.
I mean, TBIs don't discriminate. Just
they do not.
You can slip on the ice playing sports, right? I think mine was due to the auto accident, but from that injury, I actually sustained a stroke in my left prefrontal cortex because of it, because of the lack of blood flow. So with, you know, these TBIs can be so complex, and not only the person, but also the TBI. And we just, the same TBI in a different person may not be the exact same outcome, right? Or the same challenges that show up. And I think that's really one of the areas I'm hoping to see a lot more for future research in, and how do we kind of say, you know, this is going to be a little bit more of your journey versus like, yeah, TBI, we know what to do. We don't know why we need to do this or to what level in terms of like dose intensity, right? 17 months of speech therapy, 2 to 3 times a week, or does it need to be 5 times a week, right? And then, you know, once that research is there, then getting the insurances on board is going to be a different battle.
Yeah, we don't even want to go into that, because right. that will turn into a multi-series session, yes, because, right. oh yeah, we could all agree on that. And so what got you started with working with people in jails? I'm interested in that.
For sure. So when I was in grad school, I did my internship at a psychiatric hospital, and they didn't, and I love working there. I still work there to this day, actually. They didn't have any social work openings, so I needed to find another job. And I found one, and it was working in a jail. And ironically, there's a lot of similarities between and a lot of differences at the same time between a lock settings, right? You're told when you can eat, you're told when you should be going to sleep, right? It's a very controlled environment. And I worked there for a year and a half or so until a social work job opened up where I did my internship, and then I jumped back in there. But I really enjoyed being inside those facilities, partially because I don't think, like, yes, we have some of those shows of like Scared Straight or even just some of those like reality TV shows of where people pretend to be convicts and they go in, you know. And I think on some level they can communicate what those places are like, but they're very much it's very much has a different culture that our parts of our society never see.
Yeah.
And
I think that's something that needs to be brought to light. And the only reason I say that is I have my youngest, he's currently incarcerated. So we've been dealing with the justice system in that regard. And it's always interesting for those that can have that ability to go in there and actually talk to those that are just as impacted is important, because we don't have the resources that we need for them to get the help that they need.
I agree. I think there's still a huge stigma in our society for those who are incarcerated, as, you know, most of those people are kind of written off on some level.
Yeah.
There's a really good book out there. What is it? I think it's Michelle Alexandria. The key. Now I need to look it up because I can't remember it. But it's a really interesting. The New Jim Crow is by Michelle Alexander.
Okay.
And it came out in 2010. And it's a very interesting book about how our society views those who are incarcerated, and how I mean, discrimination on some level can look very invisible. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the reason it's called the new Jim Crow, is because, and it uses the analogy of a birdcage, because when you take away somebody's right to vote, you take away their ability to become adequately employed to live in our society, you know, all those prongs are creating a birdcage that then essentially keep that person trapped, right? And Michelle's book is very much tailored towards how this is a perpetuating system, and mm-hmm. there aren't many avenues out of it once the criminal justice system has their fangs in you.
Yeah, that's adaptively said, because that's exactly what it feels like, and it's something that we've been working on to bring to light, is the impact that it has, not only on the person that is just as impacted, but the family. Mm-hmm. And when we are creating these situations, it's actually taking the family along with them. Mm-hmm. And the family suffers as much as the person that is behind those bars. So talking from a mental health aspect, what would be one thing that you would suggest to families to help improve their mental health while their loved one is behind bars?
It's a good one. Human beings love certainty. We thrive in it. We thrive in routine, right? And usually when that routine is changed, it's difficult. But that's also where trauma can lie, is when those routines are forcibly or abruptly and horrifically changed, right? So obviously this isn't therapy session, but focusing on those things that you do have influence over, and sometimes acknowledging that there isn't a lot, right? But you can do X, Y, Z. Maybe it's podcasting on criminal justice involvement, right? Yeah. Blogging, whatever it is, talking with your local senators, Congress people, right? About these impacts that are showing up. It may not resolve the situation for you, but maybe down the road in a decade or two decades, right? Somebody else will find themselves in those positions, and maybe things will be slightly different, hopefully better. But
that's exactly why we do the work we do, along with the group. And it's important. And you bring up a good point, because the work we're doing is not going to help our current loved ones. Mm-hmm. We're doing this for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't want to see other families being as impacted as we are. And bringing to light how opaque the justice system is.
Mm-hmm.
There is no transparency in the justice system. Zero. Yeah. And when you have a loved one that is going through that, and the mental aspect, you know, my son has gotten some therapy in there, but it's really generalized. It's not individualized at all. And even he says that group therapy is okay, but it's not the end all to be all. And that's what a lot of states run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting when you look at trying to do individual therapy in these types of settings, right? Because those cultures also don't want you to show weakness.
Mm-mm.
And especially if you're in the litigation process, like you haven't been sentenced, there's also things you can't talk about.
Mm-mm.
Right? So, because there's not always attorney-client privilege, especially with the therapist, right? And so it's an interesting setup to try to do individual therapy, provide support from a general perspective, right? Even though that there might be XYZ things you would do with that person if they were in a community setting.
Yeah.
It's like you have this hand to play and you want to play it, but you're held back, right? Because of stigma, culture, right? And you also don't want the person to accidentally incriminate themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And it's definitely a fine line. And I appreciate those that are doing the type of work of like what you're doing. At least they do have a little bit of help and maybe enough tools to where it can help start reversing that recidivism rate. And that is greatly appreciated. So along with that, as you were going through your own injury and defining it and how you resolved to change that, because I'm sure that you have seen that impact also in the justice system with somebody that's had a TBI that unfortunately maybe not have had that same support, it is now incarcerated. So what are the things that you've done to help support the people that maybe have the same things that you have, if not behind the bars, but the ones that you're working with outside?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you bring up a great point, right? Like I can't remember the statistic offhand and I don't want to misspeak, but it's greater than 50% of people who are incarcerated have some sort of TBI, whether it's diagnosed or non-diagnosed. Right. And that's a huge percentage of people.
Yeah.
In terms of when I'm working with people on the outs, because that's one of the populations and one of the groups of people that I choose to support, given my history with TBI in private practice, I think your support system will probably take the brunt of your support. How do I want to say it? Your support system will function in a multitude of ways. One of those ways will A, hopefully be support, right? But B, they're also going to be the people that see you struggle the most. And probably the ways that on the outside, you may look okay, but they'll be able to read you that like, oh, you're starting to feel fatigued, right? You're not able to find your words. Whereas from an onlooker at Walmart or Target, you may look to be doing just fine, right? And I think that's one of the hard things with TBIs and just mental health in general, is that somebody can present physically well, right? Whether they are checking out at a grocery store or applying for whatever it is, a job. But we don't know until we start the conversation and the narrative around like what happened to you, what has your life experience been like, right? Not why did you do this, but what influenced those pieces to come to play, right? And I think depending on your TBI, depending on the severity of the TBI and how kind of your identity and you are meshing or not meshing with that TBI injury, your support system may be the brunt, may take the brunt of your anger, may take the brunt of your irritability, your short statements, right? And I know mine did, especially in the beginning. And that can be very difficult because it's not like you just say somebody to be like, hey, what, you know, think before you speak, because it's like sometimes with a TBI, your brain feels like a scrambled egg and you're like, I can't think before I speak really, or I don't have that awareness before I think or before I speak. And that's very challenging, right?
It is. And that's one thing that I saw with my sister when we were helping her through it. Her filter was no longer there. I mean, she had to relearn to have a filter. And I thought that was rather interesting. And hers wasn't so much the anger. It was, I want to say, for the first couple of weeks. And I think it is because her brain to her felt like mushed scrambled eggs, because it literally was. And it was one of those things. I think she was so frustrated because she couldn't articulate how she actually felt in that situation. And I think that was the main part of her frustration.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not just frustration that like people, it's frustration at the situation, right? Like, I remember I would get so upset because I would be sitting in speech therapy sessions and you know, they would have me try to memorize a set of words and then go do a task and then come back and I could only remember two of them. Or they were like, okay, I want to know that all the different forms of there, right? Like they are there, right? And I'm just like, wait a second, I only know one. But I know that I used to know all of them. And now I'm pissed, right?
Yeah. And it takes a good while to start getting over that, or I wouldn't say necessarily get over it, but more or less start moving on from it. And the ability to start piecing your life back together and re-showing that empathy. I think that was one of the things that I noticed was completely different, because my sister is a very empathetic person. And then after that, she showed no empathy, because I don't think she could access that part for a little while. And it's interesting to me, as a person that's always been interesting in how the brain works, how she couldn't access that until later.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for why she couldn't. And I do know that from my experience, it probably took a good 6 months, 7 months for my brain just to feel like it was there. Yeah. Right. And it wasn't even working properly yet. Right. And even now, like, there are still some days where I can't find the word, or like I lost the word, right? And like those still come, but they're much, much fewer and far between than they were when I was in the hospital or directly after. But I think some of those, and that's part of the TBI too, is like from the outside, the person may look fine.
Yeah.
Right. But on the inside, everything feels foreign.
Yeah. And as a family member that's, you know, watch somebody go through that, and you're right, we can usually tell when she's had enough. And it's been close to 20 something years now or longer. And it's still some of those, it's like what you were talking about, is losing of words. And sometimes if she gets extremely too tired or too overworked, she still has those challenges sometimes. And that's when I say, you know what, maybe go lay down, take a nap, get refreshed. Yeah. So that way you can function.
Yeah. I'm still very cognizant about my sleep, because I know that's one of the things that I can control in this recovery process, right? Or I have influence over. maybe not always control the quality of sleep at night, but it's one of the things that I can influence that probably has a big predictive outcome.
Yeah.
Right. In terms of my attitude, my mood, right? My focus and concentration.
Yeah. Exactly. So as we get ready to wrap this up, I always ask, where can people find you? I know I have your website scrolling down below, but where else can they find Daniel?
Yeah, so simple Google search. You know, you can just Google Revitalize Mental Health too. But I'm also on Facebook, Revitalize Mental Health PLLC, Instagram at Revitalize_mental health. You can follow along there, just giving little tips and information, helpful tricks for mental health, grounding, awareness, TBIs, you know, support wherever I can. So you can link up with me on those channels. If you're interested in coaching or anything like that too, you can submit a form on my website.
Awesome. Daniel, it has been very insightful. I'm glad that we got to talk about this today, because it's one of the few things that I can mesh together is about inmates and about TBIs and the impact that we all have on our mental health, our brain, even though it's behind a pretty hard skull, sometimes can't survive everything that happens to us sometimes.
We can't, but the body, the human body can be pretty frail, but also very strong at other times.
Extremely.
And it's very hard to kill the human spirit too.
Yes, extremely. And that's one of the things I absolutely love, because we can always overcome things, and sometimes change, it may not be what we want, but sometimes it leads us to a life of helping people that we would have never helped to begin with.
Thank you so much, Dawn, for allowing me here.
You're welcome. And Daniel, and as always, everybody else, as I always say, whether you know it or not, whether you believe it or not, you are loved. You are the beacon of hope, and you are unstoppable. Everyone, have a good one.